Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, CEO and founder of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Anthony Kaniowski. Anthony is based in Warsaw, Poland, and is the Chief Operating Officer of US-based Good Futures. Anthony, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, nice to meet you. Thanks for inviting me.
Hey, my pleasure. Well, really excited to have you on. Really enjoyed our chat before we hit record here. But let's start. I know you have a big focus on venture building. I know you're actively involved operating Good Futures. Let's start with Good Futures. What's the company's focus, and what does your role look like day to day?
Sure. We're a CMU affiliated venture builder focused on the future of work, workforce, and AI. In essence, what will be the impact of AI on how we engage with work and at work? And under this umbrella, the two partners and I are running a company, which is an operating company, focused on building new companies that fit this thesis and are relatively cheap to experiment on, validate, and then launch to market. In essence, the companies will be filling the gaps in the hire, train, deploy model, which used to be a corporate strategy, which is now being supplanted by AI native strategies. Myself, because I come from first a technical perspective originally, I used to be a developer. Then I moved into building businesses and startups in Europe and in Poland. And now I'm using this perspective to look at how we're utilizing our time and resources and how to prioritize the essence of what is our business. Because in venture building, you need to strip off everything which is unnecessary and focus on the essence of a transaction and service and validate it as fast as possible.
So, you know, the concept of venture building has been around for a short while, but if you can go a little bit in the weeds and give us a sense of what a strategy looks like, you know, from inception to say the first year milestone looks like.
Sure. So a venture builder is a type of a fund operating company or both, which is focusing on producing companies in a repeatable fashion. And it is counting on having a higher success rate than launching companies individually, because you're relying on a set of shared experiences, know-how, and back office services that help you have better returns per venture because you're reusing that. Now, within venture building, there's a wide variety of axes along which you can order where do ideas come from, where do the teams come from, and where does the capital come from. In our case, we are doing our own ideas. We're sourcing founders from outside, particularly from Carnegie Mellon University, and we're looking for external capital as well. However, more typically, you have a so-called startup studio model where you are sourcing ideas and people from the outside and deploying your own capital through LPs.
And so, Carnegie Mellon, what was the connection as to why you guys are focused on sourcing founders from there?
One of our co-founders is an adjunct professor over there, and the founders and myself, we know each other from 6 or 8 years ago, while they were still running the previous company, which has since exited. And I was brought in as the guy who can turn strategy into operations and go as fast as possible into execution mode, cutting out all the unnecessary, let's say, craft and decorations.
And so what does a profile look like of a founder that you believe is a good fit for good futures?
So in our case, we're looking at people who have 2 to 3 years of experience, who graduated and are now looking at for an alternative to a full-time job because they have a knack for building products. And they are usually, let's say they have an innate talent that they bring from somewhere and ability to build products or to find out commercial aspects really fast. But they still need coaching, as in coaching on the direction of where is the value proposition of a business and where does the actual transaction and money come from. Because when you are in the weeds of producing a product you believe in, you are often not seeing the forest for the trees as to what is the essence of a transaction, what do the businesses in the end pay for? And this is where the structure, the mentorship comes in and helps them focus on that. I'm making this point with all due respect to the potential founders because I've been in that position as well. In my early days, I've been also building products mostly because you had to build product before you found out distribution and sales. And back then, before AI, you still have to spend a lot of, effort on actually building a product before you find out that nobody wants it. And I can sympathize with that.
So you find a founder today. Sounds like they're almost exclusively in the US. Are you looking for market opportunities in country, or are you looking more globally?
Essentially, when you're building a B2B SaaS company, you say that you're a global company from day zero because it doesn't matter where the credit card comes from. But technically speaking, there are particular network effects or particular market needs that make it easier for us to do business development right now in the US, potentially because, let's say, the barrier to entry for a new company is relatively low in the US as a high trust business focused environment where it's easy to start offering new products and services. So it's a cheaper place to offer services. And incidentally, in one of the previous companies before Good Futures, where I was hired to build a company on behalf of investors in the HR space. It was a German-based company for German investors who really understood the German market. We found out that the easiest clients we had in our first pilot client and our first real client was in the US because it was just the fastest market for us to test out, connect to people, and have willing potential leads and buyers.
So for the benefit of our audience, who are not familiar with markets outside the US, when you look at it from Poland, what are some of the attributes that you see in the US that you don't no necessarily see for adoption in other parts of the world?
The common perspective from Middle Europe and Western Europe is that for a startup in particularly, entering US by hiring a local team and doing outbound campaigns from zero is expensive. And you really have to have people, boots on the ground, US born and raised people over there to build trust. And I respect this advice. However, my personal experience has been that it has been relatively easy to find open doors when you are a small venture and a relatively small product looking for early adopters who are open to some risk, willing to test the waters, willing to give something a try just because it sounds interesting. And this type of openness is how we see the US market over from Europe. In contrast to more established Western European markets, where you have to build relationships and trust over weeks and months of negotiations with all stakeholders involved. Of course, I'm oversimplifying, and this is limited to B2B SaaS, which is its own type of business anyway.
Sure. So just while we're on the subject, how often when you find yourself in conversations talking with European founders, do you encourage them to perhaps move to the US to take advantage of the culture and the markets?
It depends on the stage of where they're at. So I can either recommend it very early on when somebody's still thinking that they're in the stages before they even started doing go-to-market and outbound, then it's the best moment for them to shift their mindset and focus solely as a US-centric or global company before they start speaking in the local language. They should first speak in English. Or very late in the life cycle, when they already know what works in their local market, then they usually raise money against the idea of international expansion, because doing international expansion at cost is relatively difficult once you have a company, let's say, of 100 or more people.
And
So very early or very late.
okay, and then again, I'm super curious to get your perspective. Is there a city or cities in the US that are generally accepted as a great place to get started?
This I would not be able to comment, but common advice is East Coast.
Interesting. I mean, I get it from a proximity perspective from the
Yeah.
other, but okay. All right, so let's come back to Good Futures. So you identify a founder, you're now your capital. Is it structured with funds from Good Futures, or are you doing it like a SPV or special purpose vehicle where you're raising around an individual founder?
So there's some capital in the company to get our wheels going right now, but when it comes to the actual funders, we're looking for external capital, looking to invest in us as an operating company with a horizon of 3 to 5 years, in order for us to build 3 to 4 companies at specific cost and to a specific theme and prospective returns. This is not structured yet as a fund, because that would impose much higher rates of return in a short term perspective, which in this model, which is leaning towards a holding company long term, is not something which is compatible with what we're looking to do. However, Christian, you are the expert here on how to model this and what is actually the optimal structure. So far, what we found out is VCs don't know how to invest in an operating company and don't want to, and I understand them. And private equity is looking for larger tickets than what we're trying to raise, but they at least understand the holding company model that we're looking to build with our own sweat equity.
Well, I mean, my take is that that these days there's no shortage of managers who or investment managers who are creating vehicles that address every single different profile that you can think of. I've met a lot of investors who will do tech-enabled professional services. I've also met ones who will only stay in very specific verticals, and that's just because their expertise base lies there. But that's also what they can use to attract limited partner dollars, as to say, hey, you're hiring me because I'm intimately familiar with where we're investing. So it varies, and I think it's a multivariate. It's people. It's stage, it's geography, it's the business model, and then of course it's the track record of the general partners who are leading everything. I do think too, there's from where I sit, that starting in a model that resembles a special purpose vehicle versus a fund may be easier. to start in the beginning, because it gives LPs a lot more flexibility, and it can be easy to get them over the line. So it's relative. I don't know that there's pros and cons on either side. I don't know that the one way is the right answer, but there's definitely elements of each investment vehicle that could be beneficial depending on where you are investing. So capital is raised, you found a founder. What's the degree that you're gonna get involved with actual company building?
Good question. It is a difficult decision to understand and be confident that this is the moment where we stop doing the actual work and we hand it off to somebody. Because ideally, you're looking at a process where the studio itself has conviction that an idea is needed, it works, and we know how to build it. A founder comes in who we understand, he or she understands what is the subject matter, and then we see them build and take this and run with it. And now there's been clearly plenty of perspectives just between the four of us about what is the point at which we're letting the founders have their own territory, right? Because one perspective says that you're looking at people who are self-directed, who know what they are doing, and they will come around to the essence of the business at some point, earlier or later, because they will learn on their own that this is where it's easier to do the business than somewhere else. In contrast to an approach where we are sitting almost jointly with them, directing them on the next steps, going through a checklist of items they need to fulfill. I would say it has to vary, and my answer would be depends on the character and experience level of the person who's involved. Personally, I've been on both sides. I've been coached by investors to execute upon a plan to build a product, as well as I've been the partner for early stage founders, representing capital, looking at whether or not they are passing the boxes and going through various stages as well. So you will see a lot of different models of validating whether or not something is ready. And usually the last 20% of any stage is an area where a lot of time and effort on both sides is wasted. Basically, what's the definition of done? How do you know a landing page is ready? How do you know that the pricing model is finished? And this is where expertise comes in, where you have to understand what to cut and where to pause negotiations, and this is good enough. We have to move forward. So, and this is where originally my pitch to you was, that venture building as a discipline is essentially using similar tools and similar mindsets to PE operators. And there's overlap. The scale is much different, but
Sure.
there's an overlap in how to operationalize and go down to the essence of a decision as fast as possible.
I mean, it makes good sense. I mean, you're looking for validation, and you also want to do this for at least in good futures perspective at scale. And so, presuming the founders are there and you've got the idea, the sooner you can turn your attention to the next company, you can generate better returns for your investors. Makes really good sense. You mentioned B2B SaaS. You also mentioned AI. They're not opposed, but there's a whole host of SaaS companies out there who've built a business on something that doesn't necessarily resemble artificial intelligence. We could probably have an entire podcast around headwinds that they're facing from their pure AI counterparts, but I'd love your perspective. How are you and the rest of the team thinking about infusing AI into the problems you want to invest in?
Yes. I would say there are two directions that are driving my perspective. To get back to your point, or we are both looking and we are both cognizant of the lowering valuations of pure SaaS companies, and SaaS companies having lower than expected returns, and SaaS companies looking to infuse AI and AI agents somewhere in the value chain. I would say that to that effect, my impression is that value AI, sorry, let me rewind. My reaction to that dropping valuations is that I have the impression that pure SaaS companies have been overvalued for the past years, and now the AI wave is a reason for them to be valued at lower multiples. It is just a factor that drives the updated valuations because there's something that they have to compete with. But this competition is, let's say, misguided in where does it come from? Because in the end, AI native companies and regular companies will be competing for the same customer. And secondly, I believe that most new companies, which are, let's say, AI native, are built from the grounds up on a different architecture, information architecture, and a different value proposition to the end customer, which is usually best suited for vertical software companies where the domain space of the problems is quite narrow and you can easily outline what is the whole problem to the model vertically. Horizontally, and this is the most companies we see now, augmented note takers, augmented video editing platforms, I would say they will be integrated and connected into the established companies anyway.
So when you guys are thinking about what ideas to get behind, what's the framework that you're using?
So we're looking at within the domain of hire, train, deploy, at gaps which are created by the tensions between the workforce and employers coming from AI. And the tensions are usually on the axis of volume and fit, as in if you're putting up a job post, you're either getting all the attention and too many candidates, or none at all. If you're getting too many, that's because both sides are using AI to maximize coverage, right? So you have many candidates overfitting their profile to a job post. And now what do? You have to build extra moats and build extra tools in order to filter what previously self-filtered. And this is just an example of looking at the potential gap in the market, which is created by the introduction of AI. This type of tension didn't exist before you were able to customize all your CVs with one click and auto-apply as things happened.
It's an interesting way you frame it. I think you said something to the effect of these touch points where that creates friction between employees and the employer. And you got me now thinking about where there maybe exists. And I have a bunch coming to my mind. Okay, so as I think about this, the nature of work evolves
Yes.
by virtue of the fact that you now have a whole host of new tools that are helping both employees and employers. How do you mitigate your risk knowing that the technology is evolving very quickly?
We've seen this firsthand as a few of our ideas have been basically one-shotted by newer models, and basically our building of it doesn't make sense anymore because a new model comes with a sub feature that solves that. But I would say that the answer here goes back to, let's say, business fundamentals of where do you find the scale or leverage at which you want trust an automated platform anymore, or it will end up being just as much work as before. Right now, we still have, let's say, leeway in terms of if we are promising to deliver candidates to a company which have been profiled and filtered in a particular way, we as a company or one of our ventures will still have more, will be trusted more than an AI native single company where as when a robot or AI is doing that. But this might change in the near future. So I would say, to answer your question succinctly, it is the intersection of distribution and trust. How do I find a provider that can actually deliver on the promise of training up my workforce? How do I test that I can actually trust them? Have I met an actual person on the other side? And then why am I paying for a serve for a B2B service instead of buying something self-serve? And here, this is quite difficult depending on the size of your operation, the size of your employee base. But I would say there's no clear-cut answer here. We are all looking for solutions. Let's say that most of the eyeballs on LinkedIn, at least, are concentrated on people who are building automations that replace solid B2B relationships. But I think there will always be place for companies that are delivering services to the extent and skipping out automations.
So, what was your professional experience leading up to Good Futures that put you in this great spot to be able to see this opportunity?
Prior to Good Futures, I was hired by a German consulting company to bring their idea for a potential product into fruition. In the end, I built a company valued between 3 to 5 million euros from scratch, with, as I mentioned in our chat before, with first clients in the US and further clients in Germany. And this was a particularly interesting topic for me to work for because I was working directly for investors to augment their consulting business with a product business. So I had to deliver, let's say, a made-to-measure company solving a particular problem or demand in HR that came from their insights from their regular consulting work. And this type of small, let's say, this is you have a small brief, but unlimited territory. And this is a very interesting area to be in as a founder. And I managed to land that opportunity because prior to that, I've been also a management consultant with some experience with BCG Platinian. And I bring some experience from self-funded solo bootstrapped ventures, as well as other market tech startups, where I performed a basic company turnaround from being in the red to in black by securing a global contract. So let's say that the path towards this is different for many people. Most people come from large exits from one company that they've been doing for 10, 15 years, and then they are looking to multiply their capital by building multiple companies at the same time. This is the typical venture building profile that I see. But finance people also come in from a different perspective when it comes to looking at this as a long-term, almost greenfield vehicle for building multiple companies at a cheap rate. And this intersection between the financial perspective and operating perspective is what I find most interesting for me.
So as you reflect back on your experience over the years, what were some of the biggest lessons you've learned?
This will be quite controversial, and I'm saying this from a perspective of somebody who used to be product focused. The product doesn't really matter in the end, because in B2B, you're selling the promise that you will deliver a type of service, something will be solved. And how this is solved, as in what is the interface, what is the friction, what are the buttons, is secondary to the fact that the thing has been solved. This advice is particular to B2B relationships, does not apply to B2C types of businesses, but this is my sole focus. And looking back at the approach that I've seen with my younger self and also younger colleagues is that coming from the startup environment, you're thinking a lot about the product as the essence of what you're producing as a startup, but essentially you should be focused on the transactions that you're producing. You should be going to the bottom of what is a transaction and how do I render it as soon as possible, as fast as possible. And product is just a vehicle for doing that transaction. And this shift in mindset is something which I think younger generations are already aware of, but we coming from the perspective of you have to build a product first, then you test it, then you iterate, then you sell it. We had to learn this the hard way.
So it sounds like to me it's a mind shift, a mind shift, in that you're being graded on outcomes. It just so happens that you're using this thing, it's called a product, to generate those outcomes. But at the end of the day, your success is going to be based on how your customer, in this case, a business customer, assesses your outcome,
Yes.
not the means by which you deliver.
Yes, exactly. This is what we're counting on,
Yeah.
as a
No,
studio.
it makes really good sense. And I think it comes back to what you said earlier, was, I think it is a mistake to just say, let me build it and have it come, because to your point, it misses that you're not selling a thing, you're selling a set of results. How you achieve those results is going to be proprietary. You own the product, you've come up with the process. But I think it makes really good sense.
Thanks. I'm glad I found somebody who's seeing it the same way. And it took a while, for these thoughts to surface, but also to find a fitting audience. Because when you're coming from VC territory, where the appearance of growth is very important, you're shaped to have a different perspective on what success looks like and what growth looks like. Because you're battling for attention, that you're growing the most interesting portfolio, which is growing at a particular pace. And when you're coming from a finance perspective, like you are, or the PE, then you're looking at different markers and you're judging things much more, in my opinion, objectively.
Well, I think part of the way to have a great relationship between a founder and investor is ensure that expectations are aligned. Founders need to appreciate that professional investors have their own clients, and what they're offering them is a return. And so, there are definitely funds out there whose mindset is, hey, this actually may not be a 10-year fund. This could be a 20-year fund. And it's their responsibility to ensure that my opinion is their responsibility to ensure they're aligned with their investors. And so I think it's good to have those conversations as founders and investors are getting to know one another. Because yeah, if there's a mismatch on timing expectations, it's going to make for a rough relationship.
Absolutely.
Anthony, I genuinely appreciate your time and sharing your perspective with our audience. Before we wrap up, if there's anyone who's interested in getting a hold of you and learning more, how can they find you?
There will be my LinkedIn link in the summary of this podcast episode.
Okay. And do you have a website or an email you want to direct anyone to as well?
I think LinkedIn is the best channel right now.
Okay. Done. And with that, again, for the benefit of our audience, Anthony Kaniowski, Chief Operating Officer for Good Futures. Anthony, again, I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.